time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by on-camera and voiceover talent RodHunter.com and the law offices of Matthew Simone. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist Bob Siegel.
Welcome to our sanctuary. What do I mean by sanctuary? I mean a sanctuary for skeptics and doubters, a place where questions are welcome, a place where we consider it reasonable to ask for facts or evidence before accepting the claims of Jesus Christ, a place where we don't say, well, brother, you have to just accept it on faith. Never mind that we don't have any evidence. We respect you, we respect your questions, we respect your skepticism, and we address it directly. On our last program, I offered some reasons for the historicity and reliability of the New Testament. Today, as promised, I'm going to discuss the ancient testimony to Jesus outside of the New Testament. We'll begin with the Jewish witness. Now, although the original church was made up primarily of Jews, most of the nation of Israel rejected Jesus as the promised Messiah, and the Jewish priests and teachers were particularly hostile to him. In the Talmud, an ancient rabbinic storehouse of law, wisdom, and commentary, Jesus is described as both a sorcerer and an apostate. Now, Christians may shudder to see Jesus, their Lord and Savior, insulted like that. But friends, historically, and that's what we're talking about today, history. Historically, this is an extremely valuable corroboration, and I'm glad these words have survived. Remember last time I mentioned that people frequently talk about the bias of Jesus' disciples? They were his friends. They liked him. We can't trust him. And I pointed out that all historians, all eyewitnesses are biased. I pointed out that that shouldn't be a problem. I still stand by that. However, today we do add another piece to the puzzle because now we see another bias, this time a bias predisposed against Jesus by people who were his enemies, by people who did not like him, and they nevertheless confirmed that a Jesus existed and was executed. Why was he executed? What were the charges? Well, the charges are listed right there in the Talmud. He was executed as an apostate and as a sorcerer. Now, what was an apostate? An apostate was a heretic. For an ancient Jew to call himself God, the God of Moses, the God of Mount Sinai, the God of Israel, indeed, the God of the entire universe, the one and only true God, for an ancient Jew to claim that, well, you couldn't have a worse heresy. You couldn't have more of a heretic unless, by chance, this man happened to be telling the truth, and he really was God. But obviously, the ancient Jewish court known as the Sanhedrin did not believe Jesus' claims to deity, so it's understandable that they called him a heretic, or in their words, an apostate. But I'm intrigued that they also called him a sorcerer. Why? Because in those days, if you didn't like somebody and you didn't want to follow somebody, but nevertheless you could not deny the fact that this man was doing miracles, what did you do? You said, well, he didn't do that by the power of God. He did that by the power of Satan. Yeah, it's supernatural, but it's sorcery. What we are left with then, my friends, is an excellent non-Christian testimony with a bias predisposed against Jesus, which nevertheless reports that he lived, he was tried, he was executed, and during his life he did miracles. Isn't that fascinating. Now, there's another very important Jewish witness, but I'm going to skip over him today. This is Josephus. It's called the Testimonium Flavianum. Josephus was not a Christian. Josephus was an ancient historian. He talked very matter-of-factly, not only about Jesus' miracles and life to some degree, he didn't spend a lot of time there, but he also mentioned that Jesus rose from the dead after being tried and executed by Pontius Pilate. The reason I'm not going to go through that today is that I did an entire program about this. So we're not going to be redundant, but there's a lot of detail there. And there is a lot of controversy about this passage. I take a lot of time to defend its authenticity. For now, I will say this. We can confidently add Josephus' testimony as a Jewish, non-Christian verification of the resurrection. Moving on now to another very important witness. Have you ever wondered where the disciples and Luke obtained their detailed information about Christ's trial, since they did not witness it personally, and their detailed information about his burial? It seems that at least a good deal of it came from Pilate himself. It was standard of governors to make judicial reports and send them off to Rome, but Pilate went even further, writing a lengthy letter to Emperor Tiberius. In this letter, commonly referred to as the Acts of Pilate, he describes Christ's trial and talks candidly about the many events surrounding the resurrection, including all of the events discussed earlier about the guards and the tomb. He even goes on to describe other biblical accounts, such as the stone being rolled back supernaturally. Only he's not calling them biblical accounts, he's calling them his account. The stone being rolled back supernaturally, the darkness, the earthquake. Finally, Pilate confesses his own conviction that Christ must have been who he claimed to be, a decision he unfortunately arrived at after Jesus' trial. Just think, events so compelling that the Roman governor himself re-evaluates the identity of Jesus. This makes the Acts of Pilate one of the most amazing and persuasive secular witnesses for the gospel. Now, there is one problem, and it's a significant one. This document doesn't actually exist today in any museum. That is, it doesn't exist anymore. It has either been destroyed in the passage of time or possibly lost and waiting to be rediscovered someday, like the Rosetta Stone or the Dead Sea Scrolls. All right, now before you throw up your hands in disappointment with a broadcaster who so quickly pulls the wind out of his own optimistic sails, let me reassure you that what does exist today are other ancient documents referring to the Acts of Pilate. There are four such testimonies, and we're going to look at them in a moment, but first, it should be pointed out that much of the writing from the ancient world has been lost. This is nothing new. This is nothing unique. Pilate's report is by no means a rare exception. It is not uncommon to reconstruct the likelihood of one source by looking at other sources. As the noted scholar F.F. Bruce puts it, people frequently ask if any record has been preserved of the report which, it is presumed, Pontius Pilate, prefect of Judea, sent to Rome concerning the trial and execution of Jesus of Nazareth. The answer is none. But let it be added at once that no official record has been preserved of Judea which Pontius Pilate or any other Roman governor of Judea sent to Rome about anything. And only rarely has an official report from any governor of any Roman province survived. They may have sent in their reports regularly, but for the most part, these reports were ephemeral documents, and in due course, they disappeared. Justin Martyr, an early Christian apologist, made clear reference to a document called the Acts of Pilate in a letter addressed to the Roman Emperor Antoninus Pius in AD 150. That's a long time ago, and not long after the time of the New Testament. The New Testament was completed in the first century. This is the second century. Justin Martyr, a Christian apologist, referring to this document called the Acts of Pilate in a letter addressed to a different Roman emperor, Antoninus Pius, AD 150. He writes, "And the expression, they pierced my hands and feet, was used in reference to the nails of the cross which were fixed in his hands and feet. And after he was crucified, they cast lots upon his vesture, and they that crucified him parted it among them. And that these things did happen, you can ascertain from the Acts of Pontius Pilate." Justin went on to list many of Jesus' miracles, such as the healing of the blind and the lepers. He also credits Jesus with raising people from the dead. This description of Jesus' deeds is concluded with the following words: and that he did those things you could learn from the Acts of Pilate. So twice now he's mentioning the Acts of Pilate. Justin assumed that this record still existed in the official Roman archives, and that Antoninus Pius, the emperor, could verify the facts easily. Justin's whole purpose in writing his letter was to obtain mercy from the highest official in the known world, thus sparing the Christian community a persecution which was becoming so commonplace. It is unlikely that Justin would ask a Roman emperor to check a document if he did not feel extremely confident that the document existed. Otherwise, he would be foolishly putting his own life and reputation at risk. Another early Christian leader, Tertullian, and we date him around 160 to 220 AD, he wrote to Roman officials about the unusual events surrounding the trial, death, and resurrection of Jesus, discussing a time when the Roman Senate actually considered classifying Jesus as a Roman deity due to the miraculous nature of his life. He wrote the following: to go back to the origin of such laws, there was an old decree that no one should be consecrated a god by an emperor till he had been approved by the Senate. Marcus Amelius followed this procedure in the case of a false god, Alburnus. This reinforces my argument that among you, godhead is conferred by human approval. If a god does not satisfy man, he does not become a god. So according to this, it is for man to show favor to God. Tiberius, then, in whose time the name of Christian came into the world, when a report of this doctrine reached him from Palestine, where it originated, communicated to the Senate, making it clear to them that he favored the doctrine. The Senate, however, because they had not examined the doctrine for themselves, rejected it, but Tiberius stuck to his own view and threatened to execute any who accused the Christians. In this same letter, Tertullian specifically mentions the armed guards at the tomb, the sealing of the sepulcher, the rolling back of the stone, the guards scattering, the earthquake, the darkness, the spreading of a false report about the disciples stealing the body, and Christ's last words on the cross. After this long discourse, he says, "All these things Pilate did to Christ, and now, in fact, a Christian in his own convictions sent word of him to the reigning Caesar, who was at that time Tiberius." There's another historian, Eusebius. He also tells us that Pilate knew about Jesus' miracles and resurrection, and that he made a report of such matters to Emperor Tiberius. A church historian commissioned by the first Christian emperor Constantine at a time when the pre-Christian Rome's documents were undoubtedly still available, Eusebius' witness is key. Well, some will immediately argue here that Eusebius was a biased Christian historian, but years earlier, a non-Christian historian named Tacitus, and we date him about AD 56 to 117 approximately, Tacitus also verified Pilate's report. Writing about the great fire of Rome that Nero blamed on Christians and disliking Christians himself, Tacitus sought to explain the origins of the movement. He writes the following: "Their originator, Christ, had been executed in Tiberius's reign by the governor of Judea, Pontius Pilate, but in spite of this temporary setback, the deadly superstition had broken out afresh, not only in Judea, where the mischief had started, but even in Rome. All degraded and shameful practices collect and flourish in the capital." See, degraded, shameful, superstition. This guy's not a Christian, folks. And yet look at what he is testifying to. A famous historian, reputed in his own days as being extremely careful and factual, Tacitus would not have been prone to writing about a movement without first checking the Roman archives to see if he could not get the most accurate report possible. As you can see, in talking about early Christianity, he referred to the trial under Pilate. We assume that this information came from Pilate's official report, because any other source would have been hearsay to Tacitus. He would have compared it to the definitive Roman record. Tacitus also suggests that something caused the Christian movement to break out afresh right there in Judea after Christ's execution had seemingly died things down. I find this a very interesting description. If the death of Jesus had somehow discouraged and caged the Christian movement, what would it have taken to revive it? This is undoubtedly a reference to the many testimonies that Jesus had risen from the dead, although obviously these were not testimonies Tacitus personally believed, given the way he's describing Christians elsewhere. And so, the Acts of Pilate does not exist today anymore. If it does, it's been lost, but we have four ancient documents referring to it. Before I go on, there is an apocryphal Acts of Pilate, also sometimes known as the Gospel of Nicodemus. This forged document, created sometime after the 4th century, is not the same Acts of Pilate, which I am referring to, although its author undoubtedly wanted it to pass. So I'm giving you a heads up, my friends. Be careful when talking about this. Sooner or later, you'll run into somebody who tries to educate you and thinks you're very ignorant. I am agreeing that the document in existence called the Acts of Pilate is a forgery. What I provided today was evidence for a real Acts of Pilate, which has been lost, but about which ancient testimony survives. Okay, let's wrap all of this up. Given the accuracy of the historical events surrounding the trial, death, and burial of Jesus Christ, a good inductive process concludes that he rose from the dead. This history is found in the varied and reputed witnesses whose writings make up part of the New Testament. Although obviously biased, such reports can be read alongside a quite different bias of the Jewish Talmud, painting a bad picture of Jesus, but nevertheless confirming that he did miracles and was executed. The ancient historian Josephus, not a Christian, supplies an even bigger piece to the puzzle and reports the resurrection as a historical fact. Finally, the report of Pilate himself provides many details about the burial and resurrection of Jesus. Although this document has been lost, four credible witnesses to this document still exist today, including the testimony of the reputed non-Christian Roman historian Tacitus. Is there still room for doubt? Well, all this is historical evidence, good evidence, but evidence alone. All evidence has its limitations. It can be doubted, but no more than anything else in history that we have a tendency to accept. It passes any objective historian's test in terms of the many varied sources and eyewitness accounts. Still, this is not the same as proof. This is a trail of breadcrumbs left by God for those who want to open their minds and seek Him in prayer. Then you can enter into a personal relationship with God, and that will be your proof, because that relationship is something you will personally witness firsthand. This is Bob Siegel, making the obvious obvious.
Hear the bells ringing, they sing that you can be born again. Christ is risen from the dead. The angel upon the tombstone said he has risen just as he said. Quickly now, go tell his disciples that Jesus Christ is no longer dead. is power. Quickly now, reach out and receive it. But this could be your glorious hour. Joy to
today's program, I am going to continue with our new recurring series based on the diary of my trip to Israel. I did one entry a couple of weeks ago, my first trip in the fall of 2008. As before, I will share a selection in the first person, capturing a moment in time. Today, my brother Paul rented a car and we drove to Caesarea. This was my first time at the Mediterranean Sea. The rocky beach was beautiful, of course, and yes, the beach has always been my favorite place, but I can hit the beach anytime I want. I live in San Diego, after all. Today was a different beach experience. Never before had my eyes fallen upon this kind of coast with Roman columns, a Roman amphitheater, and a Roman hippodrome where gladiator games and chariot races were actually conducted in ancient Judea. Built by King Herod the Great, appointed by Rome, the customs represented by this place were detestable and despicable to ancient Jews. Slaves drove the chariots. Slaves were also forced against their will to kill each other for the hedonistic amusement of their spectators. Paul told me that most religious Jews do not visit Caesarea because, unlike so many other wonders and treasures of Israel, this site, while breathtaking, is not a holy place. We ourselves were there, of course, out of an interest in archaeology, but before the day was over, my brother did offer a very profound spiritual interpretation. He said, "The Romans were the mightiest empire on earth. They conquered Israel and later destroyed Jerusalem, sending Jews fleeing from the land. Now, 2,000 years later, we are back in the land, and all that remains of the Roman Empire are ancient ruins like these." Interesting words from my brother. As the sun set with vivid red and orange delight, I listened to the crashing of the waves. I also looked at the panorama of other ruins, towers and fortresses, waves of their own, successive waves of history, from the Byzantines to the Crusaders to the long since abandoned Muslim mosques. Civilizations come and go. Every one of these people stood on this exact same beach and stared at this exact same blue ocean with white foamed waves smacking head onto the rocks, submerging shells and sand for a brief moment, only to retreat and make ready for the next wave awaiting its own turn to join with the coastline. Meanwhile, other kinds of waves were spilling in my mind. Repetitive waves of thought, same idea, different words of description. Nations rise and nations fall. But the ocean is always there as a thundering witness. What a reminder that someone greater than the ocean is the watchtower of history. I will have other selections on future programs, but that's a moment in time, a snapshot from the fall of 2008. And right now, somebody else, some person, some tour group is standing on that exact same spot, maybe making the same kinds of observations, maybe not. But either way, they too are now a part of its history.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by the Law Offices of Matthew Simone.